I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
It's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again. You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, it's Friday morning. Time to talk with Sheldon Richman, my partner at the Libertarian Institute. He's our managing editor, something like that. Anyway, such an excellent and important piece here. You guys have got to check it out. Depopulating Palestine, dehumanizing the Palestinians. Welcome back to the show, Sheldon. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine, thank you. I'm actually the executive editor, not that these titles mean a whole lot.
Yeah, I'm the editor of the damn site, not you. But man, you write some great articles. I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
Hey, so you learned some stuff this last week. You've been writing just such a great series about Israel-Palestine lately, and this one takes the cake, man. Go ahead and let them have it.
Maybe there's a collection in the works. I'd like to dedicate this conversation, this podcast, to Benedict Spinoza.
Okay.
The great philosopher who, because this is the... I should mention that today is the 632nd, is it 32nd, anniversary of his, 362nd anniversary of his excommunication by the rabbis and the lay board of his Amsterdam congregation for what they called evil deeds and abominable actions. We don't know what those are. They didn't spell them out. But anyway, I feel he was, of course, one of the first great advocates, or maybe the first great advocate of freedom of conscience and basically liberalism. He kicks off the Enlightenment and liberalism. So we ought to, I'd like to dedicate the conversation to him.
Right on.
Anyway, so what'd you ask me about the article?
Yeah, well, I think you learned some new stuff this week.
Well, I've been reading a lot, and this is stuff I've been reading not just this week, but read some new things for me this week, and absorbing a lot just over time, and saying something I wanted to say, which was to bring a distinctly libertarian approach to this conflict between Palestine and Israel. I mean, we see certainly very good analysis by a lot of people, and a lot of good history has been written. But what that always requires some analysis too, and I thought there's always been a kind of a flaw in the analysis, and this is what it is. We get into arguments about, you know, was there a Palestine? Was that a distinct political entity? Was there a people in that area who thought of themselves as Palestinians, etc.? I mean, we've all seen arguments about that. There've been books and there've been counter books, and you know, that we have Golda Meir saying there's no Palestinian people. We have Newt Gingrich these days saying there never was a Palestinian people. There was never an independent country called Palestine. Why did this arise just because of Israel? Must be anti-Semitism. End of case.
I saw one yesterday where a member of the Knesset said, well, there's no such thing as a P in Arabic. So therefore, there was no Palestine. And so therefore, I don't know what you're talking about.
How about, would you believe, Philistine? It goes back to the Philistines, PH. So what does he think of that? But anyway, I wanted to cut through all that because I believe that's all secondary. Now, I think those are important questions. You know, was there a group that thought of themselves self-consciously as Palestinians? All those are very interesting and even important. I will say important questions, historical questions and sociological and political. But I think they're secondary, and this is something that every libertarian should immediately see. So I'm trying to reach beyond the libertarian community and talk to other people. What counts is not whether these people call themselves Palestinians or whether they were regarded as Palestinians or whether that territory was called Palestine or thought of as Palestine. What matters as a primary issue is did these people legitimately own land and property in that territory? In other words, they were individuals. Before we decide if they were Palestinians or not, whatever you want to call them, we know for a fact they were human beings, individual human beings. And so that's what matters. And once we understand through the history, by reading the history, that there were lots of human beings there who acquired property legitimately, namely through what I'll call the Lockean, you know, from John Locke, the Lockean method of being tillers of the soil, mixing their labor, etc. In other words, they honestly acquired their property. We can declare this legitimate. Then that answers so many of the other questions that follow about them being run out. You know, the Nakba, the catastrophe that occurred in 1947-48 at the hands of the soon-to-be Israeli, part of that, a lot of that occurred before there was formally a state, before it declared independence. So let's call it Israeli, even though I'm talking also about pre-Israel. Israeli armed, forces, armed militias that drove people out of their homes at gunpoint, bayonet point, and slaughtered hundreds of them, drove hundreds of thousands, 800,000 or so, away, and slaughtered hundreds in a couple of horrible cases of villages, and then used those massacres to scare other people to leave. Those were individuals, human beings. No matter what else they were individuals. And as a libertarian, I want to say, when I'm deciding the moral issue and the political issue, that's all I need to know, full stop. And so that's what I think is fresh about this. I mean, libertarians shouldn't be surprised, but I hope in the broader community that's interested in the subject, they'll see this as something fresh and cutting through a lot. Because otherwise, we get distracted by when did they begin to think of themselves as Palestinians?
Well, and the thing is, I mean, you shouldn't even have to be a libertarian at all, right? Like any person, I think, ought to be able to tell that when someone says, "Well, there was no nation called Palestine," that's a completely ridiculous red herring. Who cares if they were occupied by the Brits or by the Ottomans or the Chinese or anybody else? There's still people with property rights. As simple as that.
We have to rid the analysis of what I'm calling methodological collectivism and be methodological individualists. I stress the word methodological. We're not talking about, you should believe in free markets. That's a whole other subject. We're not talking about that today. I'm talking about how do you do your method? We're talking about individual human beings. Human beings come in individual units. We have rights by virtue of being human, not by virtue of being Jewish or Palestinian or Muslim or Arab or Christian, but by virtue of being human. And we gain legitimate control over a piece of land in the Lockean manner of working it, changing it, farming it, bounding it, things like that. And these people did that. So that, as far as the political and moral case goes, that's really all we need to know. Now, like I said, there's plenty of other interesting things, and the article goes on to talk about the deep roots of the people we call Palestinians. It's even misleading to call them Arabs, although the lingo is not going to change, and there's just a matter of convenience. But you'll see in my article, I know, Scott, you already know this, but others will see in the article, that it really does oversimplify to call them Arabs, because these are people who were there from pre-biblical time. I mean, their ancestors were there from pre-biblical times. The place was conquered, several times, by the Romans, and then you have the Arabs in the, 7th century. Arabs and Muslims, later Ottomans. So people always mix, right? There's always mixing of people. So nobody's a pure Arab in that area, because the Arabs, when they came, obviously probably settled down and married with people who were there before. But they go back to the Canaanites, the people from – you read about the Bible, Deuteronomy, I can't remember his name now, who blew the trumpets at Jericho and all that biblical crap, basically, Joshua. They went in and conquered people. Now, they killed a lot of people, if we're to believe the Bible, but who knows how historically accurate that is. But they probably didn't kill everybody. So a lot of people were there. People were still there, and then the people who settled, the newcomers who settled, mixed with those people, and you get this amount. You know, you get this. This happens throughout history. So you have a continuous presence of people who then later on, you know, intermarried with the newcomers, whether they were conquerors or peaceful newcomers. And so the people today that we call Palestinians have their roots going back to from time immemorial, to use the title of an infamous book on this subject. So that's
as opposed to the mythology, which is that. And I mean the modern mythology, which is that this was a land without people. And in fact, you know, I've heard it claimed that, listen, the only reason these Arabs came is because the European Jews came and made the desert bloom. And then all of these evil Arabs decided to come from, I don't know, Saudi or Jordan or somewhere to try to steal it all from them.
Well, that's an old mythology that, the Zionist movement propagated. And then it was revived. I mean, it was beaten back quite a bit by historians who actually knew what they were talking about. But then there was a book, this is the infamous book I referred to, that came out in 1984 called From Time Immemorial by someone named Joan Peters, who's deceased now. Some people doubt she actually wrote the book. They think it was just she was just, you know, induced to put her name on it, which a very long book, like an 800-page book with 1,800 footnotes that claimed to show that if you look at the population studies that have been done, the censuses and stuff done by the Ottomans and the British, and all these reports that were being churned out by government bureaucrats over those years, in fact, yes, the people we call the Palestinians were mostly recent immigrants attracted to the Jewish development. And then she also had claimed to have made a fresh demographic study that confirmed all this, that in fact the refugees, the people we call Palestinian refugees, were only recent newcomers to what became the State of Israel. That book was completely demolished in a short time by Norman Finkelstein. You can look online and find stuff by him about this. The book also, by the way, while it was lavishly praised by American intellectuals, I stress American, I mean, Barbara Tuchman and prestigious names said this is a wonderful book. The book was ridiculed and dismissed out of hand in Israel and England in the major publications and journals. So just to give you some perspective, I linked to one article about this whole episode that Noam Chomsky writes about Finkelstein and his attempt. And he was just a graduate student at the time, Norman Finkelstein at Princeton, doing his dissertation on Zionism when this book came out. He had to put everything on hold and read this book. And he went through every footnote and just showed where she cheated and misstated quotations and mangled quotations and misinterpreted things and basically lied and did some other very sneaky things. I mean, it was unbelievable. But here's the thing I want to point out. And it goes back to my original point about individualism, methodological individualism. I can grant Joan Peters' thesis. I mean, I don't do it, but for the sake of argument, I could say, okay, you're right. These were recent, and by recent, you know, a couple of decades, not days, recent Arab immigrants who were attracted to, let's say, Jewish economic activity in Tel Aviv and, you know, that area up and down the coast of the Mediterranean. Let's say that's true. That couldn't justify running them out of the country when Israel is getting ready to declare its independence, because no one said those people were on stolen land, right? There's no immigrants. They were living somehow legitimately on land, however, renting property, you know, however they were there. I never heard that they stole anybody's house. They just came and moved there. So, but on what grounds do you run them out or do you slaughter them? There are no good grounds for that. And therefore, even if you grant Joan Peters' crazy, you know, idiotic, totally dishonest thesis, they still don't get where they want to go. You can't get there from here, from her, you know, where she wants to start. So, again, it gets back to my methodological individualism. All I need to know is that these are human beings. The rest is a footnote. That's my bottom line on this.
Right. And now, but speaking of footnotes, man, you have some real footnotes in here, such as this quote from David Ben-Gurion himself.
Well, in 1918, I learned this from Shlomo Sand. Shlomo Sand has written three really wonderful books, heavily documented. He's a professor of history, maybe emeritus now, professor of history, Tel Aviv University, right? Born in, he wasn't born, moved, I think he's Austrian. So his family after World War II moved to Israel. I don't believe he was, I think he was born shortly after. I think he was born in a, possibly in a displaced persons camp in Europe. I may be confusing him with someone else. Anyway, moves to Israel as a child with his parents. So brought up in Israeli culture, Jewish by birth. I don't know how much of an upbringing. And then professor of history at Tel Aviv University for a long time. He's written three very important books. The first two are the most relevant, and actually the first one's the most relevant, although I linked to the first two. The Invention of the Jewish People, and the second one was the invention of the Land of Israel. Very heavily documented books, very readable books. So the point, I learned this point I'm going to make about Ben-Gurion from his book. Now, by the way, when he says the invention of the Jewish people, he does not argue that this is a special case. He says most national groups, maybe all national groups, were invented. So it's not like a special case that the Jews did this or the Israelis did this. All peoples end up getting invented. In other words, when countries got centralized or unified in the 19th century, like Germany, like Greece, Italy, you know, they were city states, they were provinces or little separate states. They didn't have a common culture. They didn't even speak a common language. They often couldn't understand each other. The dialects were that different. But when some uniter like Garibaldi unites a country like Italy into a single state, he and his people then have to create a national consciousness. Just like with the United States. In the United States, people thought of themselves as Virginians or New Yorkers, not as Americans. So an effort has to be made to get them to think on national terms. So the famous quote out of Italy is Garibaldi's, one of his people, says, okay, after the unification, he said, okay, we have Italy. Now we need Italians. In other words, we got to get thinking of people not as being Sicilians or, you know, whatever the various provinces or regions were. Now they have to think of themselves as Italian. Same thing with Jewish people. So it's not an exception. The title might lead people to think, oh, that's an exception. And they'll say, well, don't all peoples get invented some way or another? And the answer is yes, they do. So let's go back to Ben-Gurion now. I learned from Sand the following thing. In 1918, Ben-Gurion, first prime minister of Israel, and he has a co-author, a historian by the name of Itzhak Ben-Zvi, who was the second prime minister of Israel. In Israel, like a lot of parliamentary systems, the president is pretty much a figurehead. Prime minister is like the head politician. They put out a book in 1918, Eretz Israel, which means Land of Israel, in the past and in the present. And what Ben-Gurion and Zvi write is that the Palestinian peasants, the Fellahin as they're known, go back to biblical times. In other words, they're from the original Judeans. In other words, they're saying, look, we're Jewish settlers. We want to settle Israel, make a state out of Israel. These are our people. This is what they were saying in 1918. These Palestinian Arabs we see here are our people. And as they put it, the Fellahin are not descendants of the Arab conquerors who captured Eretz Israel and Syria in the 7th century CE. The Arab victors did not destroy the agricultural population they found in the country. They expelled only the alien Byzantine rulers and did not touch the local population. Nor did the Arabs go in for settlement. In other words, the Arabs who came from the outside, right, they came from Saudi Arabia, the big desert. They didn't go in there, kick everybody out, and start their, and take it over. It wasn't a settler colony. They wanted to rule it, but they wanted the people to keep farming and so they could pay the taxes and also produce the goods. So here's Ben-Gurion and Ben-Zvi saying, these people we see all around us, by the way, it was obviously wasn't a land without a people. These people we see all around us, they're our people. These are our kin, as they would say in Hebrew. They're our mishpacha, our family. That's amazing, isn't it? Because that's not the story we get today. And as Sand explains, as Arab nationalism began to rise up, and I would say a Palestinian consciousness, and it resisted the Jewish settlers who were coming in and kicking the Palestinians off land, kicking them off their land. This is before the state was even founded. As they resisted the Zionists, suddenly now the pioneering Zionists said, whoops, these aren't our people. They're not us. And they disowned them, basically. And then they propagate this myth that there weren't people here. Mm-hmm. That once the Jews got kicked out by the Romans, that was the Jews wandered the world and have been waiting to get back to Israel ever since. That was the new story, because these people who once were the family were now saying, why are you stealing my land? They didn't like that. One more thing about, I mentioned the exile, about how this land was empty, according to the mythology. Sand points out and confirms that the Romans didn't kick the Judeans or Jews, whatever they were called, the Hebrews, whatever they were called back then. They did not kick them out in 70 AD, famously when the Second Temple was destroyed. They didn't kick them out because the Romans didn't do that kind of thing. First of all, the Romans kept voluminous records of everything they did, the Roman authorities. There's no record of wholesale removing everybody and emptying out Palestine so that the Romans could come in. That's not what happened. That's not how they did things. They wanted taxpayers and farmers too. So there was no exile. And Sand, when he was writing his chapter on this book, he went to the Tel Aviv Library, University Library, which is, he says, is a very decent library, to look for books on the exile. He didn't know this yet. And he figured there'd be walls of books about the exile. He says every little village in Palestine or Israel, there's a book about, at least one book about. So about the exile, surely there's going to be like many, many books. He goes in there, he can't find one book. So he said, what the heck's going on here? He goes to the Department of Jewish History, which is separate from the Department of History, where he was in Tel Aviv University. And he talks to the professors and says, why are there no books about the exile? And the answer he gets, and he does this in his charming Israeli accent, he says, well, it wasn't exactly an exile. And he says, why do you lead people to believe there was an exile? He said, hey, we don't ever tell people they're in exile. You can find his lectures online. He says, you go out into the hallway and stop students in the hallway and say, were the Jews exiled by the Romans in 70 AD? And they'll all tell you, yes. Where are they getting that idea? And they all say, and the scholars say, we didn't tell them that. No, but they let them believe that. Mm-hmm. And so there was never the wandering Jews. That's a major point. They were there continuously, but they converted and they intermarried again as other groups came in and conquered or visited or moved in.
You talk about that specifically too, that when the Arabs came and the Muslims came in the 7th century, that they didn't exile them either. They needed them to pay taxes, so they kept them.
That comes out of Sand also. They didn't, first of all, they didn't have the means to do it. As Sand says, they didn't have the means of transportation back in the 7th century. They didn't have the trucks.
So in other words, what you're really telling me here, quite contrary to what everyone in the world is led to believe, is that the Palestinians really are descended from the original Hebrews going back to the 2,000-3,000 years. And the Poles, the Lithuanians, the Russians, and the New Yorkers, who claim to be the original Hebrews, are in fact Poles and Lithuanians and Russians and New Yorkers.
Well, it certainly looks that way. Certainly, it's reasonable to say that most of the people that we call Palestinian Arabs, Muslim and Christian, were those original people, and they were Jewish at one point. But then, when the Roman Empire accepted Christianity, some converted to Christianity. And when the Arabs came, a lot of them converted to Islam. And as Sand points out, one reason they converted was they would be exempt from taxes if they converted. So there was a very good reason to convert. You wouldn't have to pay taxes. So, but they didn't want to have to. They were willing to do that. So whatever you think of that, that's secondary. The point is they changed religions. And of course, yes, there's always intermarriage, right? This happens over the centuries. A group of people is never so isolated, for the most part. And as new groups come in, whether either by conquest or by peaceful methods, people, and I wrote about this a few weeks ago about the freedom of association. That's the natural thing. People intermarry, right? The young generation says, hey, maybe I'm X, but I like that girl over there who's from group Y. And then they get married and they have kids. And before there, now you have mixing. So there's no, you know, there's no pure race or ethnic group or nationality.
All right, y'all, here's who sponsors this show. Mike Swanson, author of The War State, The Rise of the Military-Industrial Complex in America After World War II. It's just great. And also he gives investment advice at wallstreetwindow.com. Subscribe there. And when you do, you'll want to follow his advice and buy some precious metals for your savings. You go to Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc., RRBI.co, and tell him Scott sent you. Read No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani, How to Run Your IT Business Like a Libertarian. Zencash at zencash.com or zensystem.io, and thebumpersticker.com. Stickers for your band or your business or whatever you need, thebumpersticker.com. And if you want a new 2018 model website and you want to save some money, go to expanddesigns.com/Scott and you'll save $500.
So that's the story. That's
and again,
story.
Back to the beginning, this is just a footnote because none of this really matters anyway, other than the truth is the truth and it's important.
They're human beings. That's what I say is primary. Secondary, this is the other stuff is interesting, very interesting. And the other thing I do in the article, because I don't think, I'm not saying it's unimportant. The fact that I say it's secondary doesn't mean it's not important. There was Palestinian consciousness going back to even the 10th century. I didn't discover this person. He's famous in some circles, but I only learned about him recently. There's a 10th century Arab geographer by the name of Mukaddasi, something like that, who wrote a well-regarded book in the 10th century, late 10th century, about that area. And he discusses Palestine in very distinct terms, in terms of culture and agriculture, culture, the people. And then we have other things that would prompt the consciousness. Namely, you know, here's the thing. A group may not think of themselves so much as a group when they're left alone and they're in peace. But as soon as there's colonialism or outside oppression or pressure, that prompts the development of group culture. Like, oh my gosh, look at this. We're surrounded. Or
yeah, rally people around the flag, like Americans supporting George W. Bush after 9/11.
No, but I don't mean it in that negative sense. It's just that, look, if you see that a group of people are coming in and want to kill you or take your land, you're going to say, hey, I have something in common with all these other people who are threatened by this this power. So I'm not saying it as a negative thing, like nationalism. I'm saying it as that there's certainly a group solidarity, like, hey, we're all in the same boat. We're all under attack here. So that happens. And in 1834, an Egyptian ruler, and I stress Egyptian now, that means he's Arab in this case, in 1834, rules Palestine. Even though it's still part of the Ottoman Empire, he gets some sort of autonomy within the Ottoman Empire. And the inhabitants of that area that we call Palestine, and that word Palestine is used in Mukaddasi's book, by the way. So it's an old word going back to the Romans from Philistine, which is, we know from the biblical times, right? Anyway, the Palestinians now, I'll call them Palestinians, didn't like the Egyptian rule. He wanted to conscript their sons and take away their guns. They didn't like that. And so they revolted against this Arab, this Egyptian Arab. So if they were only Arab, if they only thought of themselves as Arabs, why are they revolting against an Arab? They didn't like the outsider. They regarded this guy as an outsider and his people. So they revolted. No, they lost, unfortunately. But that's the kind of thing that forges an identity, a group identity. And then it happens again later with the Ottomans. And then it happens in the early 1920s, because under the Sykes-Picot Agreement between England and France during World War One, they're going to carve up the Middle East after they take it away from the Turks, which they proceed to do. One of the prominent people from one of the prominent families, the Hashemite family, after the war, don't forget they had promised independence to the Arabs and then screwed them. They broke the promise. They never intended to keep the promise. They said, revolt against the Arabs and we'll give you independence. They revolted and they didn't get independence. So a guy gets himself declared king of Syria, which is one of the areas given to France, Syria and Lebanon given to France. And this guy, not Hussein, Faisal, who's the son of the Sharif Hussein, he gets himself named king of Syria. But guess what? The French don't want that. They're going to rule Syria, and so they kick them out. Now, Palestine for a long time was regarded as the southern province of Syria. It was still distinct in people's eyes, but it was still kind of attached to Syria. It was a southern province. But when the people that were still hoping for some independence, I'll call them Arabs now. I mean, we know it's actually a group that's, you know, a very mixed, quote, blood. I don't even like to talk in those terms, but we'll call them Arabs just because for convenience sake. But the Arabs living in Palestine now and prominent people, when they lost Syria, when the French said, no, you can't have your king, and they kicked him out, he ends up, I think, in Jordan. People in Palestine say, okay, we lost Syria, now we must maintain the independence of Palestine. So the consciousness becomes even greater. So there's plenty of episodes where we can see the gelling of a Palestinian consciousness, and we see this. So no, was there ever an independent country called Palestine? No, but again, as I said in the beginning, that's not what matters. The point is, they didn't just start becoming conscious of themselves in 1967, which is a typical Israeli story, or 1948 perhaps. But a lot of times people say, oh, they wouldn't even think of themselves as Palestinians until 1967. You know, where were they before that? Well, they were there before that. And so I just tried to set the record straight in this piece.
Yeah, well, and you do a hell of a good job of it. And it's funny because I just had some Hasbara troll on Twitter yesterday saying, oh, yeah, an invented nation that never existed. And then I just stayed out of it because I was going to say something really horrible. But so luckily, someone else chimed in. The person who I'd originally retweeted chimed in and said, oh, yeah, and I guess the people are just imaginary too, huh? And, of course, no response from that. The people, all states are fictions anyway. They're just legal constructs. Humans are real.
That's my opening point. That's right. And now all we need to do is throw the Ben Gurion Ben Zvi book at them, saying, "Oh, were these people hallucinating? Were these two guys hallucinating?"
Yeah. What does Ben Gurion know about it? Right.
Well, they saw people all around them. Were they hallucinating? And not only did they see people around them, they said, hey, this is our kin folks. Right. We descend from you.
Which and really also, just goes to show how dishonest it is. As you say, they had to change the story that, well, geez, if a bunch of basically white Ashkenazi Jews from Europe are going to come and seize this land, we better make up an excuse for kicking these people off it. So now they're the aliens, not us.
Right, so they kicked them out of the family, basically. And you mentioned, the Poles, the other Europeans that came. There's certainly plenty of evidence. I mean, that's been building up over the years, that Sam discusses that the Ashkenazi Jews, the ones that are in Europe, were in Europe, Eastern Europe, and then further west, they never went back to Palestine. I mean, and this story, by the way, is in all the older major histories of the Jewish people, because I once went to a decent library at a Jewish school and looked at the major works. This was back in the 80s sometime, and looked at the major works of Jewish history. And they all acknowledged this. They didn't say it was controversial. They certainly didn't say it was an anti-Semitic myth. But that a large, maybe most of, or if not all, of the Ashkenazi Jews don't have a direct line back, because the Judaism, the Jews were converted a lot of people in the first century or two of the Common Era. They converted people in large groups, kingdoms in Yemen, in where Iraq is now, in northern Africa. The Berbers were converted. Who knows? Gaddafi's ancestors might have been Jewish. Who knows? And also western Turkey and Khazaria, which was a huge kingdom north of the Caucasus Mountains between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. It was caught, this is the 8th century, the king was caught between the Christian world on his, to his west, and the Muslim world to his east, and he was concerned, if I choose sides, I'm going to get the other side mad. So what did he do? He converted to Judaism, which means this whole population was converted to Judaism. I think with forced circumcision in some cases, but we won't go into that.
Yikes.
That's too painful.
Boy, convert me to Christianity.
anyway, they then got, eventually, they were around for 400 years. And they conquered and invaded the Georgia, where Georgia is today, and Armenia. And they went south of the Caucasus Mountains and did some invading and converting.
Now, let me ask you this, because people get really upset about that. Nuh-uh, this Khazar thing is a big lie, and it's been debunked and this and that. So what do you know about that?
Well, it's not been debunked. It's been modified. There's a guy at the Johns Hopkins Medical School by the name of Aaron Al-Haik, who's got a very busy, serious DNA project going on. And he says, you know, don't forget, in the 70s, Arthur Koestler, the famous Arthur Koestler, wrote a book called The 13th Tribe, which is about the Khazars and how they converted. Now, Al-Haik tells me, and I am in contact with him, that we know a lot more now. A lot more has been learned since Koestler. And so he thinks that before the Khazars were converted, there was a community in Western Turkey that was converted, and it had towns that sound very much like the word Ashkenaz. And he says you don't find those, that name, anywhere else. A lot of people think it began in Germany, but he said there was no tribe in Germany. The German areas went by different names over the many years, normally by prominent tribes. He says there's no tribe that's got a name like Ashkenaz or Ashkenazi. But in Western Turkey, there are a couple of towns or villages with words like that. And a lot of Yiddish has words that come from Turkish or a Turkic language, like the word synagogue and yarmulke are not Hebrew words. They're not Yiddish or German words. They're Turkish words. So there's a lot of evidence about this. And he's actually doing DNA evidence with using ancient bones from people buried in, you know, Palestine, Israel, Palestine, and comparing to people, you know, today, Ashkenazi Jews. And he's not finding support for the idea that Ashkenazi Jews go back to biblical, you know, to
Judaism. I think I read a thing a couple years ago that said that through mitochondrial DNA and this and that, that they traced the Ashkenazis to two women who had come originally from Palestine, from whatever, Israel, ancient Israel.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know that. It sounds inconsistent with Al-Haik's work because these were conversions. These weren't people who just intermarried with Jews and then became Jews. The king
said, well, it could have been a little bit of both too, right? You had some women who had come by whatever means to Europe from whether they'd ever been exiled by the Romans or not, right? People travel.
Well, okay, it's not impossible that somebody traveled, but the point is there are a lot of people. If the Khazar story is true, I mean, it's in conventional history, so it's not like a fringe position. Given the Khazar story, there are an awful lot of descendants who were convert. You know, from there were a lot of descendants from converts, from proselytes. So they weren't the. It wasn't the. They are not the descendants of people who intermarried with people who came from, you know, the land of Canaan. They're people who came purely from Khazars who converted. In which case, the line stops. It stops at Khazaria. Or Western Turkey, wherever it might have originated. So yeah, I can't say that nobody, you know, nobody in Khazaria has a claim. It wouldn't be a claim, but a bloodline back. But that doesn't seem to be the major part of it, because this kingdom right. converted. It was a large kingdom. I don't know what the population was. This is a significant kingdom, and the king converts, which converts everybody, right. And they were. Jews. I mean, there's a lot of eyewitness testimony from, you know, people who wrote histories of the day. One Arab observer says they had red hair. Well, guess what? I have red hair. My son has red hair. My father has had red hair. My grandfather had red hair. He's from Lithuania. So does that make me a Khazar? Maybe. Yeah.
Hey,
I am an advocate of, you know, Khazar self-determination now. That's right. My new identity politics.
Hey, I just got this email from Jeff Deist. He says, Scott, is the TGIF some kind of Friday series or articles? If so, it gives a weird and jarring breeziness to this important and serious article, like TGIF, 2-for-1 margaritas.
No, it stands for the goal is freedom, which my wife came up. I wanted to do a Friday article. I started a Friday article when I was the editor of the Freeman for 15 years. So in 2006, I was starting it up. And I wanted it to be on Friday because that way it would, you know, it would be the top thing all through the weekend. Mm-hmm. That was my plan. So I thought, okay, what can I do with TGIF? And I spent a whole day kind of in the back of my mind most of the time thinking, what can I use? What can I make that an acronym for? And, you know, dumb me, I couldn't come up with anything. So I said to Cheryl, I need a good, you know, something I can
use. Your lovely and wonderful wife, Cheryl.
She just says in 1 second, without giving any thought, the goal is freedom. I spent 24 to 48 hours trying to think of something.
She's a really great lady, that Cheryl, isn't she?
Yeah, and it was brilliant. It was brilliant, and I give her the credit all the time. But it stands for the goal is freedom. But of course, it's also on Friday, so it's right. Thank goodness it's Friday. I want to cash in on that. It has nothing to do with the restaurant.
Right. I was just thinking, man, I could use some bacon cheddar potato skins here.
I get no money from them.
Yeah. Well, that wouldn't be kosher at all, would it? Bacon and cheddar. Hey, listen, man, thank you so much for coming back on the show and talking about this stuff.
Oh, I always enjoy it.
Sure is great. All right, everybody. That's the great Sheldon Richman. Check out this incredible article. It's running, of course, at the Libertarian Institute, libertarianinstitute.org today. It'll be running on Monday on antiwar.com as well. Depopulating Palestine, dehumanizing the Palestinians. Thanks again, Sheldon.
My pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
All right, y'all, that's it for the show. Check me out at libertarianinstitute.org, scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, twitter.com/scotthortonshow. Appreciate it. And buy my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan.